This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
If you didn't come to party, don't bother knocking on our door. Ladies and gentlemen, we are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and there is a lion in our pocket, and baby, he's ready to roar. Welcome to the L-shaped studio in Hoho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, for yet another edition of The Longbook Hunters. I am your hunt guide, Greg Phillips. With me is your other hunt guide, Nick Duke. Nick, are you ready for our safari today?
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
Yes, you see, it's been quite a period here for the hard-traveling fanboys. Sicknesses and cold areas and ice on the roads and perilous work circumstances and
bubble guts.
Bubble guts. And all of this has been happening here in the hard traveling area. And there have been some that have raised some questions about why we didn't talk about certain topics last week. Well, the answer to that is that some of us handle victory better than others. And so I know where our boundaries are. So we shan't be talking about such things. Instead,
your veiled pot shots are quite frankly boring to me at this point, Greg.
No, I'm just saying. I'm saying if the shoe had been reversed, perhaps the trepidation would not have been there last week. But
let me put it to you like this, Greg. Let me put it to you like this.
The shoe had been reversed.
Much like CM Punk once told John Cena, I want you to understand something. You, Greg Phillips, and your kind have become what you hate. You have become the New England Patriots.
Does it make you happy to say that?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It doesn't make me happy to say that.
Well, all I can say is I'll take it. But, that being said, all respect in the world to my companion here, my heterosexual life partner, through the journey of our journey into mystery. Anyway, and we're going to make your blue eye turn brown tonight by talking to you about a story that...
If your brown eye was blue to begin with, I think you should seek the advice of a medical professional, but that's just me.
We're going to discuss a book that I brought up in last year's countdown of our worst DC comic stories of all time. The DC comic stories that just churn our stomachs. And it may have been my number one pick for that, Nick. I can't remember.
God, I really don't remember either. It's been so long, and it would require me to actually be able to retain some of the information we talk about on the show, which I have no interest in doing. So,
no, nor should anyone.
Nope.
And I think I figured it out, though. I believe that this was my number one lowest-rated DC Comics story of all time, and it's a story that comes to us from 2004, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, Nicholas.
I have no. I don't know, and I don't care to know.
Yes, 2004, and this is a story about a man named AJ. No, not AJ Styles. AJ Lieberman.
Did you say it's a story about a man named AJ?
Well, our podcast is sort of a story about a man named AJ Lieberman, because he is the author, the writer, if you will, of a little book called Batman Hush Returns, from 2004, as we mentioned. And this is a sore spot for me in particular, because this was, believe it or not, the follow-up to one of the most popular and enduring and, for me, important Batman stories of all time, Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee's Hush, which had come out beginning in 2002 and running through 2003, and was the book responsible, by the way, for getting me back into comics after 5 years away. I would not be doing this podcast right now, or at least if I were doing a podcast right now, it would probably be about wrestling on Place to Be Nation. Instead, I'm with my Place to Be Nation pop colleagues because of Hush. That's how important the story was to me. It hooked me back. It's an emotional favorite of mine. It'll always have a special place in my heart because of that. And and when that story was done, originally, the plan was, after that first year, Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee were going to take some time off, and then they were going to come back to it and do a follow-up to it. Well, something happened, and I still don't really understand what happened or what. Maybe it was Jeff Loeb eventually leaving DC that prevented this from happening. Maybe it was delays on the end of Jim Lee. I don't know. But the Hush follow-up never happened with that powerhouse creative team. And instead, what we got was DC finally got tired of waiting, and they said, this character's so hot, this storyline was so popular, quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, we just have to follow it up. And they decided to approach a writer who did not really have much of a resume to speak of at that point in comics, mainstream U.S. comics, didn't have any sort of well-loved or beloved runs on a title. And finally, they settled on A.J. Lieberman. Now, A.J. Lieberman has done some fairly well-received independent work. He has also done, after this, he did a little run, before this, I think he did a little run on Harley Quinn, the old series Harley Quinn, and he did a Martian Manhunter miniseries, and a few little other things here and there, but largely an unknown writer. And he comes in and he takes over the title Batman Gotham Knights, which was actually such a great title in theory, because Gotham Knights was a series that was focused on the Batman family, kind of what we're getting now in Detective Comics, Nick.
Right.
And it focused on Nightwing and Robin and Red Robin, or there wasn't Red Robin at that time, Nightwing, Robin, Huntress, people like that, all working together with Batman. Unfortunately, after a certain point, the title kind of dovetailed into just really bizarre directions, like Bane being the brother of Batman and stuff like that. So by the time Lieberman comes on, Gotham Knights is already damaged goods, in my opinion. But Lieberman comes on, and so I, at the time, start buying this book because, by gosh, Hush is coming back. I have to read this. And unfortunately, what results is something of an abomination. Nick, I'll let you take over for here, because I feel like I'm talking too long already, but book,
it's fine. I
don't know where to begin with this one.
Yeah, I haven't really slept this week and don't feel that well, so you please, I mean, go ahead and talk all you want to, because my answers are going to be short, sweet, and to the point. But, it's one of those things that I think. You know, I read it this week for the first time as a result of this podcast. It's one of those things that you had been building up how bad it was in my head for so many years that it was pretty much impossible for it to be as bad as you made it out to be. I'll put it that way. There are parts of it that I think are god-awful, and there are parts of it that I think are just bland, boring, and generic. And make no mistake, it's a really bad Batman story, but it was not... You know, it's the worst kind of bad Batman story in that it's bad and largely uninteresting. It's not even, like, fun to make fun of at a certain point. There is just so much in it that is just they take characters like the Joker and Hush, who are supposed to be these really unique, complex characters, and just turn them into generic crime bosses. And it's just,
yep,
it's bizarre. It is a bizarre story in that context.
Yeah, it's let me start off at the top with what I think goes wrong from the very get-go. Lieberman comes aboard, and apparently, for reasons that elude me, is given basically free reign to do what he wants with the characters, it seems. So he comes on and appears not to have even read the entirety of the book that is the sole origin of the character that he's working on. The only time Hush had appeared was in the storyline Hush. And this is literally his second appearance in the DCU. And so you would think that Lieberman would go back alongside his penciler, Al Barrionuevo, who we'll get to a little bit later on. And you would think he would go back and read the story and make sure, because God, it's not like you have to pour through 50 years of continuity to get things right. You have to pour through 12 issues just to make sure that you're getting the basic details of this one character right. You can skip all the other stuff and just focus on what Hush did. But instead, there are just basic details that are wrong from the get-go. Okay, early on in the series, Bruce becomes aware that Hush is back in Gotham, or at least someone claiming to be Hush. And for those that have read the original story, at the end, it's left ambiguous whatever happened to Tommy Elliot, a.k.a. Hush. In fact, here's the part that people always forget. At the end of Hush, it's not even clear that Hush is Tommy Elliot. That's just the most likely scenario, but it's never flat-out stated that he's Tommy and never proven that he's Tommy. So Hush Returns starts with the supposition that A, yes, Hush was absolutely Tommy Elliot. B, Batman, to prove this, believes that he must go and dig up a grave of Tommy Elliot and see what's in the casket of Tommy Elliot. Well, here's the problem. There was never a body recovered at the end of Hush. He jumps off a bridge and escapes, and it's left ambiguous as to whether he's alive or not, because if they found a body, then they could obviously prove it was Tommy Elliot. There is no body. So that's number one. Number two, that was number two, yeah. So they find this body, or they don't find a body because there was none, and yet in this story, they dig it up and they open up a casket for a non-existent person and find a newspaper clipping inside. It's like, my God, he's out. My God, what are we going to do? And number three, Batman turns into a sniveling coward in this story who is so deathly afraid of Hush, which is fine. I'm fine with him being afraid of Hush in some manner of speaking. But my God, this is like the least assertive Batman we've ever seen. And he's just like, he's one step ahead of me. But he's really not, because Hush in the story is an idiot. So, okay, Riggs. Hey, Riggs. Number whatever, I don't even care about the damn numbers at this point. The next thing that's just wrong from the get-go is Hush has sequestered himself. Because it's established later in the story that he's been in Gotham the entire time. Batman states that explicitly. But yet, when we first find Hush, he is in an area of Gotham that I've never seen before, Nick. Maybe you have. He's in an area of Gotham that appears to be deep in the swamps of Louisiana.
Yeah, I think he wasn't in Gotham. I think he just kind of dipped out to go, you know, train. Basically, he was combining. It's clear based on this book that Tommy Elliot is a big fan of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester, yes, Stallone films, because he's combining the training approaches from both Rocky IV and Commando into one seamless training montage. You don't have the Russian setting of Rocky IV, but you got the log carrying, you got the secluded, yes, cabin. I'm assuming they're inept KGB agents trying to track Hush and failing miserably.
No, in this case, they're inept Louisiana swamp people, yeah, trying to track Hush.
Well, to be fair, are there any other kinds?
Well, Good point. Good point. But yeah, there's even a scene lifted straight from Commando where Tommy Elliott, who has become a bodybuilder, by the way, at some point in between the two stories, is carrying a giant tree on his arm.
He's actually just seemingly become Bane. Like, he looks like Bane. He has the scars. Like, the body is kind of shaped like it. It's a weird look for Tommy Elliott in this book.
Yeah, and it's like he's always like, he's always just wearing enough bandages to where you know there are bandages there, but you can still see his face clearly, and he's always got his bare upper torso going.
Yes.
Very bizarre type of look there. So that's wrong from the get-go. From the get-go, it's also clear that A.J. Lieberman's favorite Batman story of all time is The Killing Joke.
Yes.
And that's fine in and of itself, but yes, it also appears to be the only, in the way that people say that Zack Snyder's vision of the DC universe is shaped only by Frank Miller's works in the 80s, it's fair to say that A.J. Lieberman's view of the entire Batman mythos is shaped by The Killing Joke. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Oh, absolutely. But it's weird, because it's shaped by The Killing Joke, and yet then he's not afraid to, like, change major things about The Killing Joke that change the entire story and kind of make it not the story that it was. So, yeah, what we're referring to is the fact that his version of the Joker doesn't really act like the Joker. Instead, he acts like a dude who's depressed because his wife and kid got killed, and he has a secret room where he goes and looks at pictures of his dead wife. That's right, The Killing Joke in A.J. Lieberman's mind is now canon. Not only is it canon, but the whole multiple choice part at the end, that the Joker directly says, no, we're just going to throw that out the window. And this is his origin. This is his origin.
His
wife was killed, and the entire reason he has existed ever since then is not to, you know, be an agent of chaos and cause issues for Batman. No, it's to eventually track down his wife's killer.
No, and not only that, but it like you said, he changes fundamental things about that Killing Joke origin to where now the Joker was going to, after a heart-to-heart with his wife, he was going to leave the group, the criminal group, but they force him into it by blackmailing him, by threatening his wife and unborn child, only to then send a corrupt cop to go and murder her in the midst of his scheme. And then when he gets out of the vat and gets home and sees that she's been murdered, does he then become the clown prince of crime that we all know today.
But luckily for him, the Riddler just happened to be there the entire time watching everything happen, so he can give him all the information about what happened that night.
Yeah, oh God, the Riddler. Now, this is one that I'd actually have to revisit Hush to really get an idea of at the end, but I feel like at the end of Hush that the Riddler was in Arkham, not in Blackgate, but I could be wrong about that, so I definitely need to revisit my favorite Batman story to check that out. But nevertheless, this take on the Riddler is just, for all that Hush did to make the Riddler relevant again, this book takes the Riddler and pretty much just makes him, stop me if you've heard this from Nick, but a normal, average, run-of-the-mill crime boss, basically. Because the Riddler in Hush is this schemer, this plotter, this really intelligent guy that was a step ahead of everyone in the story. Now, after some time in prison, the Riddler is a step behind everyone. He's behind Hush. He's behind the Joker. He is completely inept. He's a coward. He's a weakling. He's a useless character that somehow survives getting all of his fingers broken, his teeth knocked out, and jumping off a roof through a glass, through another glass ceiling, what appears to be about 30 feet in the air, to the ground below. Somehow survives that. Just a very bizarre beginning here. So I guess we should get into what the damn premise of this story is. So Hush has been gone for some time.
We kind of already have. Like, because the premise is so thin, because one of the things we're going to talk about, Greg, is this is only, like, apparently it's only the first six-issue arc of a, like, 35-issue story, which is ridiculous.
It doesn't end.
Not even,
it never actually ends.
Not even Brian Michael Bendis would decompress a story this much.
No, and it's obvious as you're reading it that there's not going to be any kind of conclusion. By the time you get to, what is this? This is six issues long. By the time you get to the fifth issue, and you realize they're still doing pointless flashbacks for backstory, you're starting to think to yourself, God, this is going to be one hell of a rushed conclusion if they're going to get all this finished off in the last issue, because there's so many subplots that we'll mention here in a minute. But because I do want to spare you the indignity of reading this, unless you absolutely want to torture yourself with it. But it becomes obvious that they're not going to have time to resolve all this adequately. Little did we know that they weren't going to resolve anything at all. So Hush has been plotting his revenge on Batman for, you know, a year or so, roughly, since the events of the Hush storyline. And he has rebuilt his physical strength, and he's got a little plan going of what he wants to do next. And somehow his plan involves revenge on the Riddler. That's all we really know about is he's going to get revenge on the Riddler for what the Riddler did by selling him out at the end of the first story. So Hush goes and threatens the Riddler with Riddler's life. Well, the Riddler then contacts the Joker for protection because the Joker runs Gotham. And so Riddler sends through a – somehow he contacts a corrupt police officer, a corrections officer at the prison, who somehow knows how to get to the Joker's secret hideaway and contact him. The Joker's secret hideaway, a museum. So this officer somehow finds the Joker surrounded by his clown henchmen, who, by the way, nobody in this book actually acts like they have a gimmick, if that makes sense. Maybe you can explain that better than I just did. But the Joker doesn't tell jokes, and his men don't tell jokes. I don't recall the Joker even laughing once in this story.
Nor do I.
They just talk like normal people, basically, to each other. Normal, like, soap opera people, I guess you would say.
Yeah, and that's fine for characters like the Penguin, who plays a small role, or even to a certain extent, I guess that's okay for the Riddler. Because it's a version of the Riddler here who's, like, scared out of his mind and kind of dropping the pretense and stuff. But for the other characters, you know, Batman, Oracle, all these characters are just written like normal people. And sometimes we say, you know, in criticism of stories, that this is not how any normal person would talk. But, you know, we shouldn't be reading stories about characters that talk like just average everyday office workers. Like, it's
right.
There's nothing interesting about this.
And when we say they talk like real people, they don't talk like real people. They talk like fictitious real people.
Yes.
If that makes sense. Like you said, generic office workers. Like, they talk like just generic, cutout characters from Days of Our Lives or something. You know, they just, I run an ad firm. I run a modeling agency. Here, let's talk to each other. You know, like, that's kind of what the
deal is. Is that what Days of Our Lives is about?
That's pretty much, yeah. That, give or take some sex and whatnot.
Okay.
And questions of paternity. But, yes.
Now, wait a minute. If there are questions of paternity, have they ever looked up the Mr. McMahon guy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I bet that guy needs work now. You know, it feels like pop culture didn't really appreciate him when
how he about, how about I watched the top 25 Raw moments on USA earlier, and that guy was not in the top 25.
Not
ridiculous.
Even once was he in the top 25.
That's a trash. That top 25 was a trash list, by the way.
Yeah, well, what would you have had at the top?
The top is okay, but I have bigger issues with stuff like Roman Reigns coming out the night after WrestleMania this year being in the top 10, and like Triple H and Undertaker staring at each other being in the top 25. And
yeah, you know, that was bizarre. Or Jeff Hardy doing a Swanton Bomb.
This Is Your Life not being in the top 10.
Yeah.
I had numerous issues with it, but we're off topic.
Some qualms, if you will. Well, another thing that we had numerous issues with, or I did anyway, was Hush Returns. Mm. And so, Joker doesn't tell jokes. He's not in his gimmick.
But he is, because he's got the bleached.
Like, oh, true. Yeah.
He's dressed from head to toe in his gimmick, but he's not living his gimmick.
He's living his gimmick. Because basically, as I put it to Nick earlier when we talked on the phone about this, if you have these Batman villains and they just talk like normal guys, then they're just people that are dressed up stupid. Yeah. You know, if the Joker is going to talk like this, he needs to be wearing a suit and tie, you know, or just a leather jacket over a denim jacket over a leather jacket over a denim jacket or something. You know,
his nose is rather extensive in this one.
It is. It's very prominent. And again, I do want to
prominent proboscis.
I do want to get to that at some point, the art, but the writing is just really where the focus is right now. So Joker it runs Gotham or whatever, and so this corrupt officer gives Joker a slip of paper with one name on it. Not with one name on it, but a note from the Riddler saying he has a name for him that was the answer to the longest riddle that he's been waiting to have answered. And so Joker agrees to break Riddler out of prison. And as he does this, Hush intercepts and attempts to take the Riddler. And the Joker confronts the Riddler.
I haven't read Hush in a long time. Remind me, Greg. Why is Hush angry at the Riddler?
I don't remember. It's been a while for me, too. As best I can... You remember Riddler was actually the one that was pulling all the strings in Hush, if you recall?
Yes, I do.
I think Hush was upset because the Riddler screwed him in the end and set him up to fail against Batman, basically, because the Riddler... I think also the Riddler wanted to be the only one that knew the answer to the riddle of who is Batman. So I feel like that was the deal. I can't remember exactly, but I think that there was some reason for him to be upset with the Riddler. But he felt screwed over in some way is basically what I'm getting from it. Hmm. So the Joker confronts Hush about who the hell are you to tell me to give up the Riddler. So the Joker has his goons surround Hush and beat him mercilessly. And leave him in an almost comatose state as he lays in a pool of his own blood. And so they take off the Riddler and they're trying to protect him. Then that's when the Riddler delivers unto the Joker as the Joker's having his nightly fireside chat with the Penguin. And they just talk about life and how things are going, how are the kids, you know? And the Riddler interrupts their fireside talk to give him a sheet of paper with one name on it, the name of the man that killed the Joker's wife. And this is after, as Nick mentioned, we've seen the Joker weeping in his glass chamber that he keeps with photo albums inside of his family that we've never seen before to this point in his life. So the Joker gets the name, and it's Oliver Hammett, a corrupt officer named Oliver Hammett, who never appears again or is mentioned again after the Joker threatens to find him and kill him. No, I don't mean that he's not ever mentioned again in this story. I mean he's never mentioned again ever.
It's almost like somebody wasn't paying attention at DC Editorial during the publication of this story, and then they read it and they were like, oh man, we got to put a stop to this. And so they canceled the title as a result. That's not actually the case, because the book went on for another
20 issues,
like 16 issues or 17 issues or some shit. But
but at some point, somebody canceled it mercifully, yes, and just undid everything that was done.
Didn't undo it. Like they just ignored it. If they were going to undo it, they would have had to take the time to care enough to undo it. And instead, they just acted like it never happened at all.
But it did.
It's like the Batman editorial equivalent of like Mr. McMahon's limo blowing up. Like they just moved on as if it never happened.
Why don't you just move on and try to enjoy the comic book universe? That goes for you all as well.
And what's crazy is like, you know, it's not in this story, but you and I both read, you know, did a little Wikipedia research about what followed this, and it's stuff having to do with like Hush and his heart and a pacemaker, and Paul Dini literally took plot points similar to that and turned it into a better Hush story called Heart of Hush a few years ago.
Yes. All that I know is it ends with the Joker returning to Gotham with an army of trained pigeons.
That's because he goes back to his bizarre inbred circus folk from the Killing Joke.
From the Killing Joke.
Hangs out with him for some reason.
Which is which is the only thing he says in the entire book that even approaches a joke, is when he says, there is one place I have in mind, when he's talking about places to keep the Riddler to protect him. He said, Batman has probably forgotten about it by now. I took Jim Gordon there once, and he went mad for it. And that's, like, the one thing approaching a joke that's said by him the entire time. Also, the Riddler doesn't tell any riddles.
Yeah, I gave him a free pass on that one, though, remember?
Because of his predicament. Mm-hmm. So, anyways, Hush gets the living shit kicked out of him, and he goes to this costume maker of some sort that designs costumes.
Yeah, it seems to be like the DC version of the Marvel character, the Tinkerer. Like somebody,
the Tinkerer.
Yeah, yep. Who just kind of does these things.
For the highest bidder. And this guy puts him in touch with Prometheus. Says, you can't do it alone. You need somebody else. And so Prometheus, who is in Star City right now, fighting Green Arrow, Hush shows up Batman follows Hush to Star City. Hush and Green Arrow come into contact with each other, and Hush kills a cop and takes Prometheus off, and that leads to an utterly bizarre confrontation between Batman and Green Arrow, in which I wasn't entirely sure why anybody was as upset as they were in that situation, except the cop dying made sense.
And yet, Greg, you know, if you read it in the context of the old hard-traveling hero stuff that we reviewed a few months ago, it kind of fits in with the sanctimonious douchebaggery of Green Arrow from that time period.
So sanctimonious.
So maybe the only Green Arrow story that A.J. Lieberman ever read was Hard Traveling Heroes, and the only Batman story he ever read was The Killing Joke, and he thought, how can I cross these two over? And this was his ham-fisted attempt at it.
Yeah, I just remember reading it yesterday and just being like, what in the hell, what is either of their points? What are they talking about here? What does this all mean, Basil? For God's sake. It's off-putting, to say the least.
It really is. Why does Green Arrow's beard drawn to look like one gelatinous mass instead of, like, actual hair?
Oh, the art is so...
It looks like a Jell-O mold.
His face is just... I don't even know what... He doesn't look like a human being, for one thing. Like you said, a Jell-O mold. Maybe that's appropriate, but... None of it. The art is bad. He doesn't... Oh, God almighty, that's a horrible Green Arrow. He shoots approximately 100 arrows into Prometheus.
And
doesn't kill him.
Even though he's trying to, apparently.
Even though he's clearly trying to, and says he's trying to. I don't even understand. I'm trying to scroll to this part where... I mean, turn to this part where Batman and Green Arrow have this conversation, because the dialogue is just atrocious. And they end up fighting, and again, they fight for like three panels, and then they get over it really quickly, and they're like, well, all right. And none of it matters. It's stupid. Green Arrow doesn't help Batman with hunting down the guy that just murdered this cop that apparently offended him so much because he has to go and tell the officer's family that he died. Isn't that what the chief of police has to do? Is go tell the family of the officer that he died? Green Arrow goes and does it and says this is the part of the job no one talks about. That's because that's not part of the job. Ugh. Unless you're Superman, I guess. So it's just and you can put that in there if it had been done in different circumstances, but Oliver, instead of trying to help with the investigation, makes such helpful suggestions as Batman should just give himself over to Hush.
just why don't you just go ahead and die, Batman?
It's like an extreme evolution from the Denny O'Neil days.
Yes.
He's gone from how about it to why don't you just go die somewhere?
Oh, that's good.
And then a lot of the emotional outbursts on both sides that don't really fit what's going on. An oddly naked look at the body of Prometheus as Hush is operating on him.
That's true. I didn't even pick up on that, but now that I think about it, I guess you're right.
God almighty, it's just such horrendous dialogue here. So anyway, Hush gets Prometheus. They come to Gotham. They confront the
Joker.
Here's
what I never understood. Why Prometheus? Like,
it's never explained.
I think in 2004 we were just coming off of the Grant Morrison JLA that I believe introduced Prometheus. So perhaps it was one of those things where Prometheus and Hush were both the hot new villains that were introduced around the same time, and they were doing it for that angle. But like, yeah, I would have to think there would have to be more effective choices out there than Prometheus.
Oh, here's a great line from Oliver that I'm going to need you to explain to me, Nick.
Oh boy.
He's talking to Batman, and he said, "This might be everyday life for you, but this is my city. These are my people. And unlike you, I don't have the years of experience, which allows me to just walk away from tragedy without feeling." What the hell does he mean he doesn't have the years of experience? We have been over how many times all the tragedy that Oliver Queen has been through in his life. And at this point in the DC Universe, he was an old Oliver Queen who was presented as being older than Batman.
I think what he was trying to say is that Bruce's tragedy affected him at a young age as opposed to Oliver's coming in later in life, and so he didn't grow up with tragedy the way Bruce did.
Yes, but he still had years of experience.
But I'm probably giving it too much credit, and so go ahead and mock it.
Yes, this is an old man, Oliver. This is like a veteran, you know, late 30s, early 40s Oliver Queen who's saying this. This is not like current, like, what, mid-20s Oliver Queen or whatever the hell he is. So it just rang hollow, as almost everything else did. So Hush comes back to town with Prometheus. They murder all the Joker's goons and beat the Joker down and leave the Joker a quivering, bleeding mess as he's muttering about it being his city. And he crawls off, literally crawls off through a sewer. Like, it wasn't enough that they basically completely neutered Hush in the beginning. Now they've completely neutered the Joker, almost like they think it counteracts each other. And in fact, it just reinforces how shitty these characterizations are. So Joker's been humiliated and sent off about his way, and Batman finally confronts Hush. But nothing comes of it.
Nothing at all, because they have a very brief fight, and then I don't even remember what was it. Batman gets distracted by whatever the Riddler is doing or something, and then literally Prometheus and Hush just walk away.
Yep.
Nowhere to be found. So they
never
walk away.
Seen again.
The Joker walks away. Batman walks away. And virtually every subplot that was raised in this story, none of them are resolved.
Nothing. There is no resolution.
Even the Riddler, who has managed to escape both Hush and the Joker, now just goes to Poison Ivy for some reason and asks her to protect him.
Yep.
Leaving that plot thread on a cliffhanger as well. So if you want the resolution of the story, you have to read the next 17 issues or whatever, and then watch the book get canceled without the Hush thing being ultimately resolved.
Yep, there is no resolution at all. Nothing for anything. So,
Who was that random Vesper chick near the beginning?
Vesper Fairchild. Okay, that is playing off of the Batman murderer / fugitive storyline. She was Bruce Wayne's girlfriend. And this is in the very good Brubaker and Rucka and all those guys run. And she was Bruce Wayne's girlfriend, and he was framed for her murder by Lex Luthor and David Kane, the assassin who was the father of Cassandra Kane.
So, wait a minute. Was it Vesper Fairchild or not?
It was not Vesper Fairchild. It was somebody impersonating Vesper Fairchild. Mm. You're talking about Hush Returns?
Yes.
Yes, this was somebody that was being paid to impersonate Vesper, but again, it's never explicitly stated whether Hush paid her or not. That was my implication, was that, okay, Hush must have paid her to mess with Bruce's head. But here's the problem, there's no psychological plan from Hush to attack Bruce, because Hush's entire plan revolves around revenge on the Riddler first. He wasn't planning on getting the shit beat out of him by the Joker. So it doesn't make sense, Nick, is what I'm getting at. There is no way that I can make a fake Vesper Fairchild make sense.
He got ganged up on by the Joker's henchmen. I was about to
Yes,
I was wondering.
They literally showed
us him doing cocaine and lifting weights all day only to show up and get beaten down by the Joker.
Yes, the Joker's lead henchman, Ken in particular.
Ken is no Bob, that's for sure.
That's for damn sure. Ken is like if Bob ate Bob.
And said things.
Yeah, so just not good, and the fake Vesper Fairchild doesn't make sense, and I irrationally hate the name Vesper Fairchild, so...
Do you hate it more or less than Jezebel Jett?
See, the difference between them is Jezebel Jett in the end turned out to be intentionally bad, and I don't think Vesper Fairchild was intentionally bad, which you might say, what's wrong with Vesper Fairchild as a name? And it wouldn't be bad if he didn't repeat Vesper Fairchild 400 times over the course of the first issue.
Well, to be fair, the character of Vesper Fairchild, as you said it a moment ago, wasn't really created for the likes of A.J. Lieberman to use. She was probably used in a far better story that I haven't read.
Yeah, Batman Murderer and Fugitive, which is solid. It's not great, but it's solid. And was a good story, and she was in that one. But she's only in it. I mean, I think she had been introduced like a year before that, like in 2000 or so, and she had been built up as a love interest and then murdered or whatever. But, you know, she was never a particularly interesting character in and of herself. And at a certain point, you know, it's just Vesper Fairchild is just a name that gets brought up occasionally because Batman needed more tragedy. So, anyway, all of this is going on, and then it was shortly after this they did Under the Hood, which was much better than Hush Returns and a much better sequel to Hush, by the way. So, anyway, I mean, the art sucks, too. We haven't even talked about that much outside of Oliver Queen, but the art is just highly irregular.
Highly irregular, wow.
What? Shots, I've been hanging around too many rich
shots
people.
Shots fired on this week's HTF. I don't know that we've ever called something highly irregular before.
I've been hanging around too many rich people lately. Highly irregular. I say. Ooh. I just want to do what's best for the community. Ooh. Oh, gosh, Publix. Anyway, so the art, I don't know. I thought the art pretty much sucked. What did you think?
Yeah, it was all right, I guess. I mean, it wasn't great. And other than Ollie Queen, I can't remember, you know, too many things that just outright pissed me off about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no,
I mean,
there was...
It's just forgettable. Ultimately yeah. forgettable is the way I
well, there were sequences, the action sequences didn't make a lot of sense. Like, there's the way that they were drawn, like, for instance, Hush's
yeah,
first...
Yeah, but the thing about that is, the story itself doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
So, that's
like,
a good
I would
point.
Imagine the script that was handed over to the artist was probably incoherent.
Incoherent. So. Like in one... Okay, how does Hush go from not able to fight against the Joker's goons to able to disarm and dismember every cop he encounters throughout the course of the story? I swear there are like five scenes in this book where he grabs a gun off of a cop, beats him over the head, and then shoots him. Like, have some consistency, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Yep. Also, no Nightwing in this story. Just Tim Drake shows up occasionally, literally just to talk, and then leaves. So it's really not even a Gotham Knights story. And that's not even approaching the characterization of Barbara Gordon, which I'm sure made people happy, where as Oracle, she is identifying women at this party that look like they're loose and will have sex with Bruce. And then Bruce, of course, says, oh, this isn't that kind of party. I'm not into that kind of thing.
Which is not true, because one of the things that Bruce does is... he has sex with women. That's the thing that he does. It's a well-established part of his character at this point.
He does. He does. So anyway, lowest recommendation from me. For me, this is the worst Batman story that I've read because there's nothing that I can find redeeming about it. It killed my buzz on comics at that time that was thankfully lifted by Green Lantern Rebirth shortly thereafter. And I, as far as the trade goes, don't buy it. I mean, if you find it somewhere, maybe for like $2, and you want to read a bad comic, read it. Maybe you like it. Maybe I have found through Twitter that there are some people that liked the A.J. Lieberman Gotham Knights run. And if that's you, more power to you, and let me know why I'm wrong on Twitter at gphillips8652. But I would say that there's no reason to ever buy, borrow or steal this book.
I would completely agree with that, and especially steal. There's no reason for anyone to ever do such a thing.
No, we would never advocate such a thing. Stealing is wrong, digitally or otherwise. And I don't know about you, Nick, but I went to my local comic shop and I said, order me a used copy of the A.J. Lieberman Gotham Knights run, Hush Returns. And the gentleman punched me in the face and then took the shampoo bottle out of my ass and then ordered the book.
Good Lord. I have no response.
And with that, we are going to wrap up this section and invite you for your feedback. Have you read Hush Returns? What are your thoughts? Let us know on Twitter at gphillips8652, as I just mentioned, and at nickduke87. Join us on Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. We'd be happy to have you part of the group and engaging in conversation. We've had a lot more talk recently, a lot of discussions and whatnot going on there. You can email us if you so choose. I am Greg P. at placetobenation.com. He is Nick D. at placetobenation.com. Let us know what we're doing good, what we're doing bad, what we can do better. We hope to entertain you, and if we're not, let us know, and we'll ignore it and move on to the next email. When we come back from the break, we're going to have reading and watching and the rundown. Hope you stay with us, ladies and gentlemen.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, and NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard-Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You know, Nick, we are back, and I just I had a thought, a philosophical thought during the break that I wanted to run by you. I've been reading a lot of books of poetry recently, and thinking about how they reflect on me and my own life, and I came upon one that I found was particularly apropos, and I wanted to run this line by you and get your thoughts on it. And that line is, trying to love two women is like a ball and chain.
Yeah. Now see you will quote, you know, Bellamy Brothers lyrics and call it poetry, but if we bring up some Oak Ridge Boys, you turn your nose up in disgust. And that, Greg, that is the problem.
The Bellamy Brothers.
You almost called them the Bellamy Bros.
I did. I almost called them the Beverly Brothers for a minute. Blake and Bo, the Beverly Brothers, had a great finishing move.
They should. They should sing that song. They should do a cover of it.
The Bellamy Brothers take a big old fat dump all over the Oak Ridge Boys.
Oh my God, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
And that's just on a weekend in a hotel room.
Not on a glass table or on them.
On them. Hmm. The Oak Ridge Boys like it because it reflects on their music. Big pile of doo-doo.
Okay, I guess.
Anyway, we're going to get to our weekly recurring feature where we talk about the news and notes in the comic book world.
Are we doing this first or are we doing that
first?
Yeah, let's
do this first.
All right, whatever.
And it's called The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
Sometimes right in the middle of a podcast, somebody gets shit on in a humorous situation.
you have no choice but to love it. Anyway, speaking of shit, this Gambit movie keeps losing directors, ladies and gentlemen, because Pirates of the Caribbean, Kuel Carlito, director Gore Verbinski, has exited Gambit, making him the third director to exit Gambit due to making him the third director to quit the Gambit movie since it's been in existence. So Gore Verbinski, which is a great name,
it really is.
He is out due to scheduling conflicts. The movie's been in development since 2014, and before him, Doug Liman and Rupert Wyatt both left due to scheduling conflicts. So apparently, there's a butt ton of scheduling conflicts going on around this movie, and so Gambit is currently scheduled for a February 14th, 2019 theatrical release.
Not anymore,
which we'll get to in a minute, but there. What's the deal? Why is this such a I don't want to use the word toxic, but why is this such a gelatinous situation? Why is it so much like Jell-O gelatin?
Well, I'd like to think it's because these directors are looking at the star who's attached and deciding, you know what? Probably not the best career move here. I'm gonna reconsider my participation, and I'm gonna choose to opt out at this date.
Your anti-Tatumian stance.
Tatumian. That sounds kind of sexy.
Your anti-Tatumian stance is dominating you once again, and blinding you to the joy that could be Channing Tatum as Gambit.
The only joy that Channing Tatum's ever giving me is when he was Danny McBride's man bitch towards the end of This Is the End.
I've never seen that motion film.
Well, he has a cameo. Spoiled it for you.
Well,
fuck. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm gonna go to the store and I'm gonna buy a DVD of This Is the End. And I'm gonna bring it to your house and I'm gonna leave it right there at your house, and you can watch it right after you watch the movie that I'm gonna leave it underneath, which is The Dictator.
I knew where it was coming, and I liked it anyway. That is extremely inside baseball, ladies and gentlemen. That is extremely inside. But what is not inside is the outdoor set of the movie Venom.
Wait, we're going to talk about the scheduling thing, since this is related?
Oh, yes, scheduling. I forgot about that. Let's pause on what I just said there, and let's talk about the scheduling shakeup.
Yeah, besides, did you just say the Tom Holland movie Venom?
Silence. 20th Century Fox. 21st Century Fox.
Did they really change their name?
I don't know.
Is that a real thing?
They shuffled around their X-Men movie schedule, according to the Hollywood Reporter. So, originally, New Mutants was going to be out on February 22nd. April 13th.
Oh, I was about to say.
And it's been pushed back to February 22nd, 2019. So, New Mutants has been pushed back almost a year.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Very surprising. And it will be competing at that time with the third week or second week of both Sony's Silver and Black spinoff of Spider-Man and Warner Brothers' The Lego Movie sequel. So,
oh yeah, I forgot that was happening.
We'll see how that
actual Lego Movie sequel, as opposed to just all the spinoffs they've done. Hey, I'll probably watch that. That sounds good.
Deadpool 2, however, is moving up 2 weeks, jumping from June 1st to May 18th, which is one day before May 19th.
May 19th, yes. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, because I would think, like, I understand that there's 2 week separation there, but I would imagine it would be mutually beneficial to both Marvel Studios and 20th Century Fox if Infinity War and Deadpool were as far away from each other as they could possibly get. So I think a month separation makes more sense than 2 week separation.
Let me tell you why they're doing it. They're doing it so they can get out 1 week ahead instead of behind of Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Okay.
Now, that does put it 2 weeks after Infinity War, which is bad timing.
I mean, it's a Star Wars movie, but given the fact that we haven't seen a trailer or really, like, anything about that movie, do we really think the buzz is big enough?
I was going to say, of all the Star Wars movies that there have been since the relaunch, this one feels like it has the least buzz behind it.
Well, yeah, because they haven't even marketed it yet. I mean, I'm going to go see it, don't get me wrong, but I don't know that it's one of those movies, like, I think getting closer to Infinity War hurts Deadpool more than it helps it to get a week in front of Solo, I guess.
I would agree with that personally, but I know there are many who disagree, because it's going to make money being a Star Wars movie, but
oh, for sure.
I feel like the staying power of Solo will likely be less than the staying power of Infinity War.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But in any event, New Mutants and Deadpool 2's changes were meant to avoid competition with other X-Men movies in overseas markets. Don't even understand what that means. But, X-Men Dark Phoenix is coming out this year.
Yeah, and movies often have, you know, drastically different release dates for overseas markets, so you may not, you know, I don't know.
Well, that's that. That's that story. We'll see where that all leads. But I kind of spilled the beans on the other story, which is, and this is a report, colon.
Mm.
You always know what that means when it says report, colon. This comes from Collider Movie Talk and everybody's favorite movie expert, John Schnepp. He says that Tom Holland...
Do you even know who John Schnepp is to be taking shots at him?
I'm not taking shots at him. I'm saying everybody's favorite. Everybody knows him. Everybody loves him. I don't know him, but I'm sure he's loved by some.
Would you like to know who he is?
Tell me who he is.
He is the guy who directed and, I guess you could say, starred, even though it's a documentary, in The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened. And then he parlayed the connections he made in the movie business, you know, making that documentary and the interviews he did, into a job actually covering the superhero entertainment industry. So he has some credibility, as opposed to your everybody's favorite insider or whatever snide comment you have to make.
What were you assuming it was a shot for? I wasn't taking a shot. I was merely making a joke about the fact that I've never heard of John Schnepp before, and I would suggest that most of our listening audience hasn't either.
Well, good for them.
You just like him because he's friends with Kevin Smith, and you like everybody.
No, he interviewed Kevin Smith. I don't like everybody who's friends with Kevin Smith. I don't care anything about Jason Mewes, and he's the number one Kevin
Smith.
That's
a lie. That's a lie.
No, it's not.
If Jason Mewes knocked on your door tonight and said, I need a place to crash, would you or would you not let him crash?
No! The man is a known heroin addict.
What's your problem with that?
I've already had one belligerent person tearing through my house in the last 18 months.
What? No, wait just a minute, Nick. Let me cut you off there in case your significant other ever listens to this podcast.
She was here. She knows what happened.
Yeah, but, you know, it might be a sore spot. I don't know. Anyway, that's another story for another time. Anyway, John Schnepp, who apparently is the most
just whatever. Just screw
movie expert
just
of all
time. Read the damn story. My God.
It says in the latest episode of Collider Movie Talk.
You got your snide comments. You slide into the front half of the episode. Now you got your snide comments. You got to slide into the back half of the episode.
What are you talking about?
I've got the market cornered on snide on this show. That's my job. Your job is to be all smiley and happy-go-lucky and read the damn stories.
Well, gosh, John Schnepp reports on the Hollywood.
Not be goofy. Nobody cares about you being goofy from the fucking Mickey Mouse Clubhouse. Just read the story.
John Schnepp stated that the character.
Yeah, that's good. I like that.
Would appear despite. Previous talks from Marvel Studios and Sony that the movie is unconnected to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and the character I am referring to, of course, is Tom Holland's Spider-Man. Here is the quote from John Schnepp. Spider-Man is going to be in Venom.
I'm sorry, for the last you're just saying these months. Things, and I can't help but see Ashy Dave Chappelle in my head, so it's making me laugh.
The last couple of months, we've been hearing how Sony is keeping it all separated, and Spider-Man is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But every other character that's in the Spider-Man universe is separate. All I'm saying is that Spider-Man, and I'm talking about Tom Holland's Spider-Man, is going to be in Venom. Nick, your thoughts on Tom Holland's Spider-Man apparently being in Venom?
I'm for it. I can't do that. My nose is stopped up, so I can't do the sniffing.
You gonna give me anything fucking else, Tony?
Speaking of which, listen, I don't know if Bret Hart has a daughter. I'm not really sure if she does or not. But you know,
with this.
But recent events this week should give you hope. If that could happen, if Conrad Thompson can pull that off, Greg, the sky is the limit for you.
Absolutely.
And in no way would you be marrying her just to get closer to her father.
No, that's ridiculous. Why would I ever do such a thing? I'm happy for Conrad Thompson and his upcoming wife, Megan Flair.
Oh, I'm glad you knew her name. I was going to say the Fleer who isn't Ashley Fleer, a.k.a. Charlotte.
Right.
Is that how it's pronounced, by the way? Fleer? Is that how you...
I don't know. I think so. I think it's Fleer, but I don't know. In any way, Megan.
Or is it Megan?
I don't know. It's spelled Megan, but...
Did I ever tell you about the time that Danielle's friend and former roommate Compton dated a girl named that we called Meghan because her name was spelled. Her name was Megan, but she spelled it M-E-I-G-H-A-N. Meghan.
Was it that weird girl from my English classes that ended up dating Alex at one point?
That ain't all they did together. But no, it was not.
They did the horizontal bop.
In your kitchen, no less.
In my kitchen.
We are telling tales of the school left and right on this one.
Good Lord. What has happened?
Salacious.
What has happened? Anyway,
you threw me all off kilter with all your belligerent snide comments.
About what?
Oh, various things. Some of us take victory better than others. Shut up.
That was the first 5 minutes of the episode.
Yeah.
That was all in good fun.
Started everything off on a bad note. There was no other reason for that comment than to try and elicit an emotional response. So here, an hour later, you got one. Go fuck yourself.
Oh, come on. Come on, Tony. Come on.
Nope.
Anyway, Tom Holland as in Venom, it makes sense. I mean, I understand it. I understand it. I'm a little confused as to how they're going to handle the continuity here.
I would imagine it'll be a cameo, and like it'll be one of those things where it's like, hey, there he is. So technically, you know, you can claim that it takes place in the same universe, even if Marvel has no intention of ever, like, acknowledging it, and then you just move on about your day, is what I would think, but I don't, you know, I don't
yeah,
know that.
Yeah, it is very interesting. This is one of the weirder comic book projects to keep an eye on, I think. I don't know about you, Nick, but I think this is one, I don't know if it's going to be good, I don't know if it's going to be bad. I'm just interested in seeing how it develops because it's just so weird.
Yeah, I mean, the more I see about it, the more encouraged I get just based on the Tom Hardy of it all. But,
yeah,
you know, I'm going to go see it and hopefully it'll be all right. And, you know, we'll see if the Tom Holland thing actually happens or not. I don't think the Tom Holland thing, though, is gonna make or break the quality of the movie. I have a hard time believing he has a very substantial role in it, personally. Because isn't this supposed to, like, based on what we know anyway, supposed to primarily take place in San Francisco because of the Lethal Protector stuff?
I would guess that, but I don't 100% know. I mean, there's still so much up in the air about this, in my opinion. Like, we just don't know what approach they're going to take. Because haven't we heard that they're going to do almost a horror approach to Venom?
That'd be an interesting approach to take.
Those other stories that we've mentioned are very much kind of superhero based stories, so it's going to be interesting to see what this ends up morphing into.
Right,
and then of course we'll get to Silver and Black, which I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't care.
Yeah, so I understand. I get where you're coming from there.
The movie it's been described as is like a superhero version of Thelma and Louise.
Thelma and Louise, yeah.
And let's all be honest here.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, right, yeah. Gina Davis.
Mean, if Thelma and Louise had been made in 1999, they clearly would have met on the LPGA tour, is all I'm saying.
Right, right. You're saying it would have been more Mulholland Drivey in 99. But yes, in any event, we'll see what becomes of that. But other news, DC continues its original animated movie series of original animated movies with an announcement and a trailer, actually, of the upcoming R-rated Suicide Squad Hell to Pay. Gosh dang it, Hell to Pay. And it's going to be about the Suicide Squad, hence the name, and will star Christian Slater in the role of Deadshot. Christian Slater, people. Also, it represents the return of Tara Strong as Harley Quinn, thankfully, after, in my opinion, a misstep in the voice casting for the Batman and Harley Quinn movie. C. Thomas Howell comes back as Zoom, reprising his role from the Flashpoint Paradox.
Oh, okay. Is that's what he did that, yep, in that? Okay, cool.
Yep. And Vanessa Williams will be in as Amanda Waller. Sadly, the skinny New 52 version of Amanda Waller.
Mm. And that Latin chick from Heroes is doing a voice as well.
Ah, yes. That Latin chick from Heroes.
Dania Ramirez.
Oh, she'll be Scandal Savage. Look at this list of characters. I hadn't even looked at that. Scandal Savage is in this somewhere. Professor Pig.
Oh, wow. Apparently, she also played Callisto in X-Men The Last Stand.
Wow. I don't even remember Callisto in that movie.
That's because you tried to erase that movie from your mind.
Vandal Savage will be in this one. He appears to be the main villain, actually. Vertigo, Blockbuster, and Tobias Whale, who for years I thought were the same character. Knockout, Harvey Dent / Two-Face is in this movie.
voiced by a guy named Dave Boat.
Dave Boat. There's no doubt that he's a white guy.
That's got to be a fake name.
It has to be. Dave Boat. Anyway.
Apparently it is not. He's done various things.
He's a good man, I'm sure.
Apparently Dave Boat was the voice of Thor in both of the Ultimate Avengers movies from way back when.
Wow, good for Dave Boat. You know what? Yeah, let's take back our laughing at Dave Boat's name and just acknowledge that Dave Boat's had a good career.
He also, Greg, did the ultra-important role in X-Men Origins Wolverine, the video game, of additional voices. So there you go.
So, your boy,
hmm?
Nick, your boy, Brian Michael Bendis.
Hey, didn't you skip something?
I don't think I did.
I think you did. You did.
Flashpoint. Oh, yes, I did skip something. I just looked right over that. Yep.
You sure did.
On our format sheet. And that story is that the Flashpoint movie, which is the standalone Flash movie, according to Variety, is that Warner Brothers is now in negotiations with Vacation reboot directors and Spider-Man Homecoming writers Jonathan Goldstein and John Francis Daly to direct this Flashpoint film. I'm assuming perhaps write as well. So Goldstein and Daly did the Vacation reboot as directors, and they also wrote the script for Spider-Man Homecoming. Now, your thoughts on this, Nick?
Conflicted, because I haven't seen the new Vacation remake, but I did hear it didn't exactly set the world on fire. And while I very much appreciate the work they put in on Spider-Man Homecoming, that's going to have to be a little bit different beast than what Flashpoint is going to be. Flashpoint is going to be a heavy sci-fi movie that, yeah, is going to have some humor in it, but going to have to carry a much heavier burden in terms of time travel and alternate universes and just a heavier plot than Spider-Man Homecoming did. Spider-Man Homecoming was relatively grounded for a superhero film, whereas this is going to have to be big and bold and out there and, making the move to director from screenwriter is a big jump, and have they shown any ability whatsoever to direct an action scene? I don't know. It's a weird choice, in my opinion.
I agree. One could argue it's a bit of a desperate choice, but I'm not going to make that argument. I'm just saying that if one wanted to, one could. So you're just saying that you want to, but you just don't want to take the time to. Right. I don't feel like expending the effort because, I don't know, it could end up being awesome. We'll see. Doesn't light my world on fire, but you know what? At this point, very few announcements they make in the DCEU could light my world on fire. So,
and that story was, by the way, part of the DCEU Corner, even though we didn't have a jingle this week.
Oh, yeah. DCEU Corner. Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Why does it have the Home Improvement sound at the end of it?
Because that was the Home Improvement jingle.
I recognize the Home Improvement sound that Tim Allen made, but that jingle, I don't recognize that at all.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm misplacing.
Not saying it didn't happen.
If any of our listeners out there can place that thing that I just did there to any show or movie or existence.
Well, the Tim Allen noise was definitely from Home Improvement.
Oh, the Tim Allen noise, certainly. But now I'm second-guessing whether that song had anything at all to do with Home Improvement. But in any event, your boy, Brian Michael Bendis, has announced when he's going to come into D.C. and do his first work. And
are you sure that's not a report, Colin?
This is it is a report according to Comic Book.
Oh, this is a Dash report, different than a report, Colin.
Yeah, different than a colon report. So Brian Michael Bendis' first DC Comics work will be a backup story, in Action Comics number 1000, which is a somewhat significant issue in the history of comic books. Bendis signed, of course, a multi-year exclusive to DC. Comic Book reports that the story will be drawn by DC Comics co-publisher Jim Lee.
Oh, God.
No further details were given.
We'll see. We'll see what comes of that.
At least it's only a backup story.
Yeah, and it's a backup, but I have to imagine that...
Just the idea of the creative team of Bendis and Jim Lee. Oh, it's... Pretty exciting.
It is. And we say it's just a backup, but I would imagine Action Comics 1000, I believe, is probably going to be like...
A massive book.
So a backup will probably... That backup, I bet it winds up being like 16 or 18 pages, I'd imagine. Like, it's probably going to be a pretty extensive story, even though it's technically a backup.
I think DC should find the oldest living Superman writer, whoever it is. I don't know who's still alive that wrote Superman back in the 40s, 50s, whatever, if anyone. Find the oldest living Superman writer and let him write like a, five-pager or something. We'll see if that happens. But yeah, so what are your thoughts on on Bennis's first assignment.
I'm excited. You know, as I said when he moved over, I still don't know that the Superman mythos is the best fit for him, but it's his first DC work, so I'm going to be there with bells on, which I was anyway, because, I mean, like you said, a book reaching 1,000 is just too momentous an occasion not to market. I'm just worried that they're going to wind up charging us like a $14.99 cover price,
right,
or something ridiculous like that.
Exactly. Speaking of books that are likely to have an increase in cover price, I would have to assume that X-Men Gold number 30 will probably have a special price tag on it. And that's because Marvel is hyping this up as the wedding of the century. And they finally revealed who that wedding will be. And it's going to be the long up and down, will they or won't they, relationship of Colossus and Kitty Pryde finally tying the knot. Because Kitty Pryde popped the question to Colossus in an issue this week, and they are going to get married in June in X-Men Gold number 30, according to Marvel and a video they posted. This has been one of the longest, I know you're not a big X-Men guy, Nick, per se, from the comics, but this is one of the longest running weekly episodic relationships in comic books, and which reminds me, Nick, that we are currently broadcasting the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Hey, for our two-year anniversary, we should do the top 25 moments in the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
That's a great idea, Nick. Let's do that.
I don't want to do that because that would require research and work. It was a joke.
No, we should just make it up.
Oh, like just make up things that never actually happened on the show.
Yes.
I like that. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Coming in at number one was the time famed actor Gerard Depardieu took a dump in the L-shaped studio.
At number 12, Bob Barker's impromptu Price is Right on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Anyway, yeah, so Colossus and Kitty tying the old knot there. Big deal for longtime X-Men fans. And the only problem is Marvel's timing probably couldn't have been worse because of the ongoing Batman and Catwoman engagement that feels, you know, like it's got a lot of momentum behind it right now. So I don't know. But then again,
but doesn't seemingly actually have a wedding in sight. Like, I would be stunned if the wedding actually happens this summer. So Marvel does it now, and then DC follows up, you know, 6 months or a year from now if they actually get married. Which, reminder, they're probably not.
They're probably not, right? Yeah. So yeah, I'm good with it. I mean, I think this is a relationship that, you know, it's nice to see them moving on to the next level finally, because it's been on and off, and they'll be on for a year and then off for a decade, and then on for 2 years and then off for another decade. But this feels like it's a long time coming.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I don't really have a historical context to comment on it, but I'm glad that it seems like there are some X-Men fans out there who are excited about it, which is all you can really ask for, I suppose.
Indeed. Let me ask you this. Do you think he's going to revert to his metal form
on
wedding night?
I mean, that's got to be an awesome trick to pull, right? Has he, like, I don't know, you know more Colossus than I do. Can he, like, is it an all-or-nothing proposition here? Like, or can he, like, selectively turn bits of...
I don't think he can... I mean, I will turn to Tim and Todd to correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe I've ever seen him selectively turn parts of his body steel. I think it's either all or nothing.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there'll be a bit of both, I would think. I mean, just...
Yeah. And she can turn on her phase powers, too.
Oh, yeah.
And she can't
selective. Yeah.
Oh. You know, it could be an interesting night there in the old X-Men Gold number 30.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in any event,
man, she'd be really good at that International Women's Day scene from Deadpool.
God. Oh, and that wraps up the rundown, ladies and gentlemen. And let's move on to our normal weekly segment called Redown and Watching.
What you been reading and watching? That was a Sean McDonough-like crack on your voice near the end of that called.
He picked it up! He's running the other way!
It's not going to count.
Count. Oh my gosh. I almost wish it had counted because
the call was so good.
The call was amazing because it sounded, he literally turned into the teenage movie theater workers in The Simpsons. Simpsons, yeah. Mr. Simpson, your fumble's been returned.
What are we doing with reading and watching? I didn't read anything other than Hush Returns, and it sucked. So there you go.
I didn't read anything besides Hush Returns either, but I did watch something.
I didn't.
This week. And what I watched...
Actually, no, I did watch something. I rewatched Spider-Man Homecoming, and it's just as good as I thought it was, and your opinion on it is just as wrong as I thought it was.
Oh, no. So I was going to say, it's just as good as... I agree. I rewatched it over Christmas break, and it was just as good as I remembered it, which is to say, pretty good.
I fart. But, I can't sniff at you, so I fart in your general direction.
Fart in my general direction, yes. Now, at least it's general and not specific. That would just be rude. That'd be what Herschel does, your dog, every time I visit. But
that's not just when you're here, sir. That's just all the time. Like, he is just a constant gas producer.
A constant farter.
Yes. The constant fartist.
Oh, there you go. Anyway, yes, so I watched a DC animated movie that I've been borrowing from our good friend Russell Sellers, who is the host of the Sellers Points podcast, which you can find right here at Place to Be Nation Pop, alongside all of our other friends. But I've been borrowing this from Russell for a while, and finally got a chance to watch it, and it's a movie called Batman Bad Blood.
Why did you say it like that?
Because it was similar to how Tony Schiavone said that the character of Black Blood used to look at the camera and okay. Say his name.
I'm good with it. I'll allow it. I'll allow it.
So, in Bad Blood, which is a movie I was really excited to see, it's basically, as it was originally pitched, was the story of Dick Grayson becoming Batman and taking off of the comic book stories of Batman Reborn. But, as it turns out, as is often the case with these new DC animated movies, it's actually a Danny hodgepodge of, like, four or five different Batman stories crammed into one 70-minute runtime. So, what we get in Batman Bad Blood is we get the story of Batman's apparent death, although it's obvious from the get-go that he's not really dead, but the apparent death of Batman, the forced return of Dick Grayson from Bloodhaven to Gotham to reluctantly assume the mantle of Batman, Damian's return from a Himalayan retreat, that monastery that Bruce sent him at after the events of whatever the previous Batman animated movie was. Damian comes back to Gotham to become Robin and work alongside Dick Grayson to fill the legacy of his father. All well and good. This would have been an amazing movie in and of its own self. But it's also the origin and introduction of Kate Kane, a.k.a. Batwoman. And also the introduction and origin of Luke Fox, a.k.a. Batwing. And, oh, by the way, the introduction of a new villain character called the Heretic. And the introduction of reintroduction of Talia al Ghul, who has a secret cabal of supervillains that she is using to help take over the world. There's also a brainwashing subplot involving Bruce. There's a lot in this movie. But I have to say, it sounds like I'm going to shit on it, but in fact, I like this movie a lot. It was written by J.M. DeMatteis. The characterizations are on point. The dialogue is on point. My one complaint with the movie is it was just too crammed into that damn 70-minute runtime. They needed more time at the end to flesh this thing out. I think they needed to pick either Batwoman or Batwing to introduce in this movie instead of putting them both in, because as a result, both of them kind of got a little underserved by the movie. Batwoman was probably done better than Batwing was in this one. And although the writing was very good, it's just he only had 70 minutes to work with. What really upset me at the end of the movie, because I really enjoyed this for the most part, but at the end of the movie, there is no real after effects. There are no after effects of the climax. We get about 2 minutes of a denouement, if you will, of the what happens to these characters after they win in the end. I'm not going to spoil how and everything, but there needed to be about probably 10 to 15 minutes, maybe just 10 minutes even, of seeing what happens to these characters after. And in particular, I wanted a heart-to-heart between Dick and Bruce that we never really get in the movie. But nonetheless, I have to say, as the of the post-Flashpoint DC animated movies, I would put this near the top of the ones that I've seen. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. You know, I stopped watching them religiously. I mean, it used to be that every one that came out I bought, you know, first day. But sometime around the time of Crisis on Two Earths and Flashpoint Paradox, which was shortly after, I believe, I kind of stopped watching these as faithfully as I once did. Just because of time and money and various other things that prevented me from making the investment. But I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it, because I've heard that some of the recent ones have been hit or miss in terms of their yearly releases.
Yeah. And that's fair. I haven't watched a ton recently either, but I will say that when they made the decision after Flashpoint Paradox to base their animated universe largely on the New 52 and kind of have everything in canon with each other, kind of apart from their adaptations, which are their own thing, but have every one of their original movies tied into one another and tied into a version of continuity that was sort of in step with the New 52 in a lot of ways.
So the voice actors are even the same across these Batman movies?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
Who's doing Batman now?
Oh, I believe his name is Jason Mara, if I'm not mistaken.
I didn't want to give the gig to Bruce Greenwood, huh?
No, which I think they should have. They wanted to present but here's the thing that you have to remember. Because of the New 52 thing, they wanted a younger Batman, which honestly doesn't work so well for this movie.
Not when he has a 12-year-old kid.
Right. Like he has a 12-year-old kid, and Jason O'Mara doesn't sound like a particularly old and weathered Batman. Right. He does a good job. And I really liked, it took me a while to get used to him, but Sean Mayer as Nightwing was actually good. He was not, I mean, he wasn't Doogie Howser as Nightwing, who was so great in Red Hood.
Neil Patrick Harris.
I'll call him Doogie Howser if I damn well please.
You're like the one person on the planet who hasn't seen How I Met Your Mother, and so to you, Neil Patrick Harris is still Doogie Howser instead of Barney from How I Met Your Mother. That's kind of awesome.
So Neil Patrick Harris was amazing as Nightwing, and Sean Mayer is really good, actually. I'm still up and down on Stuart Allen as Damian Wayne. I think for the most part he was good. Yvonne Strahovski does the voice of Kate Kane, and she's great in this one. Everyone on the cast is yes. Who is she? Who does she play?
She's been in some things. Let's see here. Let me turn to the old
I Frankenstein, the Astronaut Wives, Manhattan Knight, Mass
Chuck.
Effect.
I knew that was what it was, something like that. She was in Chuck.
Anyway, John DiMaggio.
Dexter, that's where I've seen her. Dexter
does the voices of Blockbuster and Tusk. Ernie Hudson is Lucius Fox in this. Nick,
wait, what?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, I'm for that. At any point, at any point, does he tell Bruce that if there's a steady paycheck involved, he'll believe whatever you want?
Pretty much. He's definitely animated to look similar. He looks like a fat Morgan Freeman in this movie.
Hey, have you ever wanted to hear Ernie Hudson do a British accent?
Yeah.
You should watch the film Congo.
I should. I actually have seen the film Congo, but it's been many years. I saw it when it came out back in the 90s.
Congo is a terrible movie, Greg.
Oh, I'm sure it is, but I saw it when it came out nonetheless. I saw a lot of bad movies when they came out.
They thought people were too stupid to read subtitles, so they gave the gorilla a thing that speaks in a robotic voice whenever she does sign language.
Mm. Well, it was the mid-90s. We didn't know any better. In any event, yes, a good movie. I would recommend checking it out. And I feel like...
No, Congo's a bad movie. We just established that.
Bad blood. I feel like what I was saying is, I feel like when they made the decision to do this New 52 universe, I feel like the quality of the original animated movie went down. Because I thought Justice League War was pretty good. I thought Throne of Atlantis was good, but not nearly as good as the comic. And I thought
I can't imagine doing Throne of Atlantis in 72 minutes. I haven't seen it.
They abandoned all of the subtlety of Orm and made him just a generic villain.
Come on.
I didn't think that one was great, but I thought it was good, you know, but nothing special to write home about. Of the ones that I haven't seen all of them. I haven't seen Justice League versus Teen Titans. I haven't seen the Judas Contract. I haven't seen whatever one it was that had Talon in it. And I haven't seen all of Batman and Son. But of the ones that I've seen, they've just kind of been, especially compared to what came before, in my opinion, they've just been average. Because DC used to, and they still do set the standard, but DC used to put out nothing but just high, high quality animated movies. And now I feel like the animation is good, but I feel like the storytelling quality has gone down a little bit.
Yeah, I could probably agree with that, even though I haven't seen one in a while. But I am interested in Suicide Squad, like we mentioned earlier,
yeah,
and Gotham by Gaslight coming later this year as well. So,
oh, and I thought of something else for watching because I watched it last night. I just remembered it.
Yes,
I was in such a Dick Grayson kind of mood. I was in the mood for some Dick last night, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in such a mood for him that after watching Bad Blood, I was like, man, that was good. I enjoyed seeing Dick Grayson, you know, have some agency.
What you're saying is you were in the mood for Dick this weekend, which makes you have something in common with our good friend Jennifer Smith's cat.
Yes, I was also in Heat, much like the cat. And I'm curious like a cat, which is why you all call me Whiskers. So I was curious about watching...
I was in mid nose blow there, Greg. Thanks for ruining that.
So I went to YouTube and I typed in Nightwing, and I just wanted to see some clips that came up from animated things over there. You just watch some Nightwing fight scenes.
It's different than when he goes to Pornhub and types in Nightwing.
Right, that's totally different. That's when I'm looking for something else that I won't get into right now. Let's just say it does involve Eskrima sticks, though. So anyway, what I found was a fan-made series from a couple years ago called Nightwing the Series. Came out in 2014. And normally I see fan film and I think, boy, is this going to suck. And that's what I thought, honestly, last night. But I said, you know what? I'm going to watch this because there's 5 episodes of this damn thing, each one at about 10 minutes in length. So I clicked on the first episode titled Deathstroke. I said, oh, boy, here we go. And first of all, it's done by a group of filmmakers, college-age filmmakers, I think. Completely free fan film stuff, just a labor of love. And instantly I thought, you know what, the video quality on this is a hell of a lot higher than it was on Watchmen Rorschach. So I watched it and I watched the episode and I'm thinking, oh, this is gonna suck. And then it goes by and there's Deathstroke and he does his thing there, and there's some mediocre acting here and there, there's some questionable effects here and there, but they're on a shoestring budget. The action scene's pretty good, and I'm like, man, the fight choreography is actually pretty good here. And then it gets through, and the version of Deathstroke was kind of cool. And I was like, oh, interesting. Then it shows you this version of Dick Grayson. And, you know, I was like, oh, gosh, look at this actor. This doesn't look like Dick Grayson very much. And I started thinking about it. I was like, no, he kind of does. And then he started talking, and I was like, he's not that bad of an actor either. Long story short, I ended up staying up an extra hour last night to watch all of these episodes of Nightwing the Series, and with the exception of the last episode, which I think they recast Deathstroke for some reason and it didn't work, but other than that part of the last episode, it was pretty damn good, I thought, anyway. I know you have to hold it to different standards being a fan film project, but I thought that, check out Nightwing the Series on YouTube if you're out there and interested in the character of Nightwing, because I think it did a lot of things really well that a lot of Nightwing writers get wrong. It made Dick Grayson have agency, have his own identity while still being tied to Batman, and most importantly to me, it got his relationships pretty well down with Barbara, with Bruce, with his character, I'm not going to spoil, that shows up at the end, with Deathstroke. It gets Damien, it gets some classic Nightwing lines in. It gets his relationship, particularly with Bruce, very, very good. And it made him feel like the star of his own show, even though a lot of times in the comics he feels like a Batman side character, or they try to distance him so much from Batman that you lose that inherent and important part of his identity in favor of focusing on the circus or whatever. So I really enjoyed this, much to my surprise.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Good to hear you praising things, which is always good.
Doesn't ever happen, does it?
No. You're always so negative.
A negative Nelly. And, like negative Nelly, I'm wearing my Air Force Ones as I bid you all adieu this week from the Hard Traveling Studios. Nick, what do we have coming the folks' way next week?
In theory, we have a Hard Travelers for Hire on Avengers Age of Ultron.
I think we're going to have that because Mr. David Sunday, our good friend and the host of Sunday Groove, or, okay, Easy Like David Sunday.
Thank you.
Is going to deliver unto me a copy of the movie Age of Ultron.
Man, you couldn't have asked him weeks ago.
And we are going. I didn't know he had it. I didn't
think to
ask.
Because you didn't ask.
I didn't think to. And so I'm going to get a copy of that movie, watch it, and then we are going to review it right here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And then we'll be ready, I believe, Nick, for the month of February.
Yes, that's true.
A time when love is in the air. And that can only mean that we're just a few weeks away from the annual return of my favorite podcast of the year, the Heart Traveling Fanboys.
Well, actually, Greg, I think this February, in honor of the big screen debut of Black Panther, we're actually doing a Black Panther month.
Well, you better damn well betcha I'm going to find a way to tie it into Valentine's Day.
Well, yeah, so we got some reading we got to do. We got two long book hunts planned for that month. So we got
two?
Yes, two. You see, in a month, Greg, there are 4 weeks of shows in February. We can't count down anything about Black Panther because neither one of us know anything about Black Panther.
You're killing our gimmick, Nick. We're supposed to be comic book experts.
Yeah, but we're not because we're white. We don't know anything about Black Panther. We're trying to learn. We're trying to learn. And in our defense, you know, we're trying to do better. And that's why, of course, we'll be reviewing not one but two classic, well-regarded Black Panther stories, to include Black Panther the Client by Chris Priest, and then from the more recent run, the first volume of the Black Panther run by famed author Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yes, indeed.
And also, we'll be taking a very special look at the universally reviled and somewhat notorious Black Panther short-lived television show that existed, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm, I do. And there's another month in February. What are we doing for that month or that week? Hard Travelers?
Well, we're going to do our very special feature-length, the review of Black Panther.
That's right. And we invite you all to listen to and enjoy this festival of comic book goodness coming your way from the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are just giving this time of year, giving of our time and effort, as you can tell from our recent podcasts and how high quality they've been, mm-hmm. and the level of effort we've been putting in.
I've been sick a lot. You can all go fuck yourselves.
And I've been tired.
Well, there you are.
So, and anyway, we're going to let you go for this week, folks. Join us next week. We'll have more material for you. We'll talk about Age of Ultron, which is a somewhat, I don't know about controversial, but a somewhat, as Marvel movies go, a fairly maligned movie in terms of MCU movies. And we're going to talk a little bit about why that may be and kind of our perhaps different take on that. Next week. But that's for next week. Hope you all have a great week. Enjoy the return of the CWDC shows. Enjoy catching up on Marvel Netflix. We'll see you next time.
Hard traveling fanboys. Hard traveling fanboys.